Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough Directions. Each week, Breakthrough Directions explores the two faces of your business, outward through marketing and client delivery, and inward, your vision, profit model, systems, team, and you, so you can grow a business you love and live the life of your dreams. Welcome to the show.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Hello, Gina. Yeah. I was just madly unmuting.
I'm not quite sure why the music didn't play. Did it play for you?
I heard it on my end.
Very strange. Well, welcome, everyone. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Breakthrough Directions here on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Gina Gaudio-Graves, the Dean and Founder of Directions University at directionsu.com. I am calling to you live this week from Bonita Springs, Florida, as I do each week on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. We have got a great show lined up for you guys now that we've got our technical issues resolved. We have got Linda Feinholz, the founder of the Breakthrough Academy at Breakthrough by Design. Linda's calling in live this week from Los Angeles, California, as she does each week on Tuesdays with me. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Gina. Welcome home, Gina.
I am so happy to be home. I cannot begin to tell you. We rolled in about midnight last night.
Oh, my. Well, as the saying goes, there's no, what is it, home sweet home? There's no home, no place like home. Click your heels.
There's
and
no place like home.
There we go.
There really is no place like home, and there is no place like my own recliner chair. Oh, my goodness, did it feel good last night.
I love it. Well, I'm so delighted that you're home and you can lean back and relax and join us in what's going to be an absolutely fabulous conversation today. I have been waiting weeks to be able to bring Dr. Pamela Whibley to our audience. You know, so often in the folks I'm working with in the Breakthrough Academy, at least 30% of our conversation is around getting people to refresh their thinking about what their business could be like. And I know of no one better to really help people reframe their own assumptions about what can be done than Pamela. Pamela's a family physician. She was born into a family of physicians. This is multi-generational. Her parents warned her not to pursue medicine, but she followed her heart. And then, having done so, only found out that in order to heal her patients, she had to first heal her profession. So we're going to deep today to talk about what it is to be in the midst of an assumption like you can't pick a different business model because this is the way the system works. And Pamela can really describe with such perfection how that assumption is wrong. So, Pamela, welcome aboard.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad to have you
Hello,
here. You
Pamela.
Know,
Hi. Yeah, and it's great. Call me Pamela. My so it's Dr. Weibel, but most of my patients and friends, you know, they just call me Pamela or honey or darling. So I usually am a first name basis kind of doctor.
I love it. I love it. So just to give our listeners a little bit of background, I would love if you could share with them what we've talked about, which is what it is to spend all those years in devotion going into a profession, into a system, and then what you recognized once you were inside the system.
Right. I think most people enter medicine from a place of divine calling. You know, it's a lot of delayed gratification, a lot of debt that you amass in training to be a physician. And for me, it was 24 years of school nonstop from kindergarten onward
before
I could, you know, had I wanted to be, you know, a transplant surgeon or something, it would have been over 30 years of school nonstop, right? So
I
that's
thought
a lot.
I was that at 19. Holy cow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're talking about people who have an incredible amount of dedication to essentially humanitarian principles. You know, they want to help people. And to come out on the other side of all that debt and delayed gratification, you know, putting off having your own family and marriage and everything else, to find out that you're in a broken system where you can't actually help people the way you had always imagined, it's kind of a wake-up call. I couldn't believe that basically what the way medicine's set up is I was supposed to be a little factory worker on an assembly line, you know, just processing people quickly and giving them drugs. And that was never my intention. You know, I was really focused on being more of a healer and less of a mechanic. So, yeah.
It's so important. I'd love to pause there for a minute, because this whole notion of designing an expertise, going after that expertise and really honing the skill, you're doing it in one form of a system, which, for instance, is the medical education system, where if you're working in hospitals, well, you have stroll time between one patient and the next. You have time to read a chart. You have time to have a conversation. But when you come out the other side and suddenly you're trying to set up your own medical practice, everything shifts.
Yeah,
and you live that change.
You know, like working for a standard practice, you know, where you slide in just as an employee after graduation, you know, you're supposed to see 30 patients a day or more. And that's like 30 people with 30, you know, lives full of trauma and struggles and, you know, tears. You can't take all that in and really help people. And so people just, you end up in this assembly line mentality. You know, basically in survival mode, how can I get you out of the room as soon as possible so I can get to the next three patients that are undressed and waiting for me in the next three rooms? And that's really not the best way to practice medicine, and doesn't really turn into healthcare. It's more of a disease billing system, really. You only touch the surface with people, and people know that. They don't feel like they've been seen and witnessed during their appointments. They feel like they've been processed as a number.
And they must also feel that they can't actually go into the details of the background, actually give a useful history. It's how do they get down to the cliff notes to give you that what they think might be enough information to actually help.
Right, and I even had a woman this week, she came and saw me yesterday, and I always ask people, well, how did you find me and why are you coming to see me? Because often they're moving from another doctor to see me, and she said, well, I feel like my doctor is a robot, is kind of like a zombie, and I go in for depression, and it's just really odd to try to share my emotions with somebody who has none.
Wonderful recognition on her part.
Mm-hmm. And she's a pre-med student, so yeah, she wants to see me, so she can actually see this new model in action. And essentially all I did is just make a decision, which I think most doctors should make, is that I didn't want to be a victim any longer. I do not feel like you can be a victim and a healer at the same time.
Oh, that's so beautifully put. When you were standing there, I mean, was there a certain breakthrough moment where you were standing in the hall and, you know, you were talking with one of your peers and the light went off for you?
Well, the breakthrough moment was pretty clear. It was 10:54 a.m. on February 28th, 2001, if you want to know my breakthrough
moment. I want to know.
Yeah, so I was doing a pap smear on a woman who had never had a pap smear before, and she was from a native Alaskan, kind of a tough woman, 19 years old, and I was reassuring her that everything would go well and, you know, just trying to make things kind of casual and easy. And all of a sudden during her pap smear, the drawers started opening and the walls started shaking, and we were in the middle of an earthquake.
Oh, no.
And I had never been in an earthquake before, and I was just obviously a little disoriented. I didn't quite, you know, because I was trying to accomplish a medical procedure, right? So I was not thinking, oh, this is an earthquake. She actually had been through several in Alaska. She grabbed my hand and led me out of the room. She jumped off the table and saved my life. I would have just kept going, right? And so running down the hallway, you know, with the lights flickering on and off, I see like three other naked people running ahead of us, and I realize, wow, I had like three or four naked patients waiting for me at the same time. That can't be normal, you know? I don't care what profession you're in, you should never have three naked people waiting for you at the same time. It's just inhumane. You cannot process people like that. And that's how we've set up medicine, as a little processing assembly line plant. You know, it could work for Toyotas, but it doesn't work for people. And they actually use Toyota manufacturing lean, I don't know, there's some sort of lean method they use in modeling hospitals after Toyota manufacturing. I was startled. I went to the hospital one day and I was looking for something, you know, I think on the kidney or whatever. And so between renal and urology, I see a book on Toyota manufacturing. And I'm like, what is this doing in the medical library? Oh, no, this is the model they use to set up hospitals and clinics after the Toyota manufacturing.
When this realization struck you, did you turn around and try having conversations with your colleagues?
It's a little bit hard to have conversations with colleagues because some of them have PTSD, honestly, from our training. They're in survival mode, and they're not, you know, they're not real open to new creative ways of thinking. They're really, their focus is narrow and on, you know, producing enough revenue for that day to make, you know, ends meet. Yeah, so I just realized I couldn't do it anymore, although I stayed at that job another year. But I ultimately knew I had to do something different.
So how did you lay the path out in front of you? If you had this feeling that you wanted something different, how did you translate that into a vision and an action plan to move forward?
Well, I think I had to fall deeper into a state of despair. You know, often people don't make that big shift until they're, you know, I was so depressed I was nearly suicidal at one point. And that's when I was able to conceive of an entirely new way to practice medicine. I was so frustrated with all these. I had 6 jobs in 10 years, and they were all the same kind of production line mentality. And when I left the last job, I had considered going back to waitressing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just missed being nice to people. I just couldn't cut people off in mid-sentence while they're crying to say they're out of time and I have to go to the next room. And that's kind of the dehumanizing medical workplace that physicians are trapped in. And so I thought, let me just go back to something simple like waitressing. But then I got so depressed because I'm really a healer, you know. I really love medicine. And I had an epiphany one night. I realized, well, if the patients aren't happy and the doctors aren't happy, and specifically I'm, you know, on the verge of, you know, wanting to not wake up anymore the next morning because I was in such a state of despair, I thought, why not turn this whole thing over to patients and have them design their own ideal clinic and I'll work for them. And so that's what I did. I got up out of bed. I called the newspaper. I said, I'm going to lead a town hall meeting. Everyone's invited. And we're going to design the first clinic in the country entirely by patient design. And so I got 100 pages of testimony.
I'm imagining the world kind of grinding to a halt and everybody's head turning to the side to go, what was that? What did she just say?
One woman years later came up to me and she apologized for not attending the town hall because she said she thought it was just too good to be true and she didn't believe it was really happening. So, but yeah, I had 9 town hall meetings in 6 weeks and collected 100 pages of written testimony, adopted 90%, and we were open 1 month later.
And I would love for you to say that again, because so often when I'm working with business owners, they think that it's an impossibility to come up with a fundamental new idea for how to design and run an effective business. So if you'd go back into those steps one more time so they really hear what devoted attention can actually create. I would love it.
I think if something is not working well in your business and both the end user and yourself as a business owner are not really happy, put the end user in charge, you know. Put the end user in charge. Have a, you know, what I had was a town hall meeting, but you could have, of course, a department meeting or meet with your clients or whatever it is, and ask them not just what you want, but what is your wildest dream? If your fantasy could come true here, what would be, you know, the ideal? and have them dream it up, write it down. I had markers on tables. They could draw pictures. They could, you know, however, you know, everyone's different. Some people are visual learners. Some people are auditory. Some people want to share out loud at the end of the town hall or your meeting. And then you just collect all the data, which is, you know, quite a lot of qualitative data, which in general we're not really great at collecting, you know, in Western the Western mentality. We're very left-brained. We're very, you know, data-oriented, but a lot of it is just quantitative data. And this is a different type of data that is harder to collect, but if you really open your mind and ask your clients or patients what they want, they can tell you exactly what to do, and then you just do it. What people want turns out to be very simple and easier than probably a lot of things that you're currently doing. So like I said, I collected 100 pages of written testimony. I read through it, and I was amazed that I could adopt 90% and be open 1 month later.
What are some examples of what you saw on those pages? And I'll tell you the reason I ask is when I'm working with folks on their profit model, I give them the assignment to go out and interview 10 current customers, 10 prospective customers, and ask what they are looking for to have solved. And there's this mysterious moment. People are so terrified to actually turn around and ask, and yet that's where the information is. So what was the information that you heard back?
Well, over and over again, the dominant theme was they want a human relationship. They want to feel like they're sitting in a comfortable living room with a friend who just happens to be their doctor. You know?
And that's what people want. Right, it's a complete antithesis of, well, I want to be in a professional environment with plate glass windows and a reception desk, and I want you in your white lab coat and all the imagery that's come to represent what medical care's environments and experiences.
Right, yeah. No, that's not what people want, and it's not what people want in, you know, probably most small towns in America and definitely in Eugene, Oregon. It's not what people want. I've led town halls through Wisconsin. That's not what they want there. Maybe in certain areas people like that more hands-off white coat approach, but I think it's a generational shift right now in that most people don't want the patriarchal medical model. They want more of a partnership. They don't want to be told what to do. They want to have a discussion.
Education.
And they don't want to be
oriented.
Right. And they don't want the reductionist medical model doesn't work. We're not machines, you know? People want a personalized, holistic approach. They don't want one size fits all. I mean, we're really having a generational awakening here. Mm. And so the old model no longer fits. But yet we're still being trained in that in medical school.
So to let people come in from the bird's eye down in, if they walked in your door now, where would they find themselves?
They would find themselves in the middle of a really peaceful wellness center that, you know, has a neighboring little building with an indoor solar heated pool that has wheelchair access where people can, you know, have water therapy sessions. I rent a little office in there that's 280 square feet in the office building, which is by the yoga studios and the massage therapist and all the other healers who are independent. You know, it's not like we're in one financial model. These are all independent businesses within a wellness center. And so people would walk in the well, first of all, they wouldn't have to wait because I do have a little couch out there and a little waiting area, but nobody ever has to wait for the most part. Their appointments, if I tell them it's 3 o'clock, we start right at 3 o'clock. And they come in to a cozy little office with, you know, a sweet little, it's sage-colored at the in the beginning of, you know, when they first walk in with a little futon and a fabric beanbag chair. I'm in a wicker chair with some nice shag. It's a sweet little shag, you know, sage carpet. It's like a living room. You're in a cozy, womb-like living room where you're sitting right next to me and you have 30 to 60 minutes or more to ask any of your questions, and I answer them honestly and give all the options. And if we need to do an exam, then we go into around, there's a little pony wall, we go around the corner into kind of a Caribbean-themed, you know, with a blue sky on the ceiling, nice little exam room where people can have a comfortable, warm setting their physical or their exam, and I have cloth gowns and cloth drapes, terry cloth drapes, so it's not any of that sitting on paper. You're not left alone in an exam room. There's no sharp instruments on display. My surgery table is all mosaiced. It's beautiful. I made that. So it's like it's being in, I don't know, a little mini art gallery slash living room that happens to be a medical clinic with your best friend. That's how it feels.
I'm sitting here saying, okay, how long is the flight to Eugene if I need a doctor? You know? It's instantaneous. Where would I rather be? Where would I rather be having a conversation? Remarkable. So I can imagine that you ran a town hall and other physicians heard about it and had a reaction to it.
Right. Yeah, I think their reaction was disbelief at the beginning because, you know, we're taught, this is amazing in medical school, we're taught to speak at a fourth grade level or less with our patients because they're really not very intelligent. Mm-hmm. You know, we're the smart ones, right? We're the ones with 24 to 30 years of education. So make sure you talk down to your patients in a really simple way because they're not that intelligent, which is just ridiculous because that turns, you know, it really creates a bizarre dynamic where you're turning adults into infants, you know? And you're turning them into these little begging children. I mean, how many times have you felt like you couldn't get enough attention from your doctor? You have to call on the phone, make it through a phone tree, beg and beg and plead for your medication refills. And you've basically been turned into a little bratty child, you know? But that's how we treat patients. We don't treat them like adults, like they're smart. And so, wow, if we could just turn that around, put the patients in charge, treat them like they're intelligent, they have all the answers that would really help us run a medical clinic or even find out their diagnosis. Trust the patient. They've been living in their body longer than you've known them, right, for the 30 minutes or whatever you've been sitting with them. They know what's going on. Don't belittle them. And so, yeah, it's really, it's a complete paradigm shift. And it's beautiful that everything works so easily then. There's no struggle. See, I was tired of this invisible tug of war in the room. You know, beyond the time constraints, most doctors are trying to figure out, they're practicing cookbook medicine. You know, you have a complaint and they're trying to figure out which algorithm to put you on and which flow sheet they need to fill out for your cough or abdominal pain or whatever it is. And that creates some sort of like an invisible tug of war because really what the patient wants and what the doctor wants are often two different things.
Mm.
The patient isn't walking in to be put.
This is so important because I think we the patients are taught that what we're supposed to want is an instant diagnosis and what's the remedy. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that at heart that's not what we actually want.
No. It's pretty interesting. What I think people actually want is much deeper than what their physical body's complaint is. You know, people come in, for example, with pelvic pain. Well, yeah, they'd like it to go away, but why are they having pelvic pain? Why are they having trouble with intercourse? Like, there's a deeper emotional discussion that needs to happen. It's not like, let me see where you are in the cookbook medicine, you know, and turn to page 44. Oh, pelvic pain. Try this pill. This one doesn't work. Try that pill. You know, it's not about
one question
algorithm.
I've just got to ask is, how much time do you spend with a patient? Obviously, in the old model, it seems like 10 to 15 minutes. Is there a prescribed time? How often are your appointments spaced out?
Okay, my follow-up appointments are generally 30 minutes, but physicals and kind of more involved if people are following up with anxiety or depression or something like that, you know, 45 minutes, but I actually can spend as much time as I want with patients. I think I recently told Linda the story of a woman who came in for a 30-minute follow-up acne appointment. I ended up with her for 8 hours, and we resolved
a
lifelong. She was a 28-year-old woman with a lifelong phobia that we resolved that evening. But it took that long to do it, and it was amazing because, you know, obviously, you know, it's pretty easy to deal with acne for the most part, and her asthma, that was a second issue she came in with. And I've known this woman for 5 years, and, you know, at the end of the visit, I'm asking, is there anything else going on? And that's the question that really will bring the truth out. You know, people come in, they get their refills, they deal with some simple stuff, but when you ask them an open-ended question, what else is going on, that's when the story starts, you know? And that was an amazing visit because at the end of the night, that woman was healed. of a lifelong phobia.
Wow.
And it was amazing.
That is so huge.
And, to answer your question, I spend as much time as it takes, and I have a lot of fun. I'm not sitting there counting the minutes or thinking, am I going to get paid for every minute? I mean, I'm having a blast because, you know, I'm healing somebody, and it's fun. I can't even believe I'm getting paid for this. I'm having so much fun.
And let's talk about that side of it, because I know you got a letter from a colleague who just said, I don't believe it. She cannot possibly be practicing medicine or running a business or getting it done. And I know I'm paraphrasing limpingly, but I think our listeners really need to understand. I'm sure that some of them are listening going, this feels like smoke and mirrors. I don't know how you could possibly actually run a viable medical practice the way this woman's
mm-hmm.
describing it.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to read that letter, part of that letter that I got?
I think it's perfect.
Okay, yeah. So I recently, you know, what led up to this letter is that there's this practice management journal called Physician's Practice, in which, you know, they give all sorts of tips on how to run medical clinics. It's the largest practice management journal in the country. It goes out to like 276,000 physicians. And a lot of times the articles, when they interview physicians, they're always complaining and they're in victim mode. And the editorial, the big story in one of them, I open up the first page and it's why I'm leaving private practice. Yet another physician complaining about how it's unsustainable and it's no fun anymore. And, you know, it gets a little old for me because I love what I'm doing and I found a model that works and I help people, you know, love medicine again. So to hear all these people complain, of course, I called up the editor and I said, how would you like a counterpiece to that called Why I'm Loving Private Practice? And he allowed me to do that, and they published that, and then they got a lot of letters back, you know, many supportive, but some in complete disbelief. And here's one, which is from a man who's a business manager of a clinic in Illinois. And he writes, because they asked me to respond to this letter, that's how I got into this situation, so they could publish, you know, the response in the subsequent issue. I don't know what to think of the article by Dr. Pamela Weibel, MD, Why I'm Loving Private Practice, in the July-August issue of Physician's Practice. There has got to be a lot that she didn't tell about her practice. How does she make a living practicing this way? She says nobody is turned away for lack of money. Really now? What world does she live in? Does she accept Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance? She must have an outside income source. How long of a day does she work? She says she is a solo doc with no staff. Well, if that's the case, who answers the phone, makes the appointments, and does the billing, makes the copies for her, deals with the mail, takes care of her computers, pays
Linda,
the bills,
can you
et
hear
cetera?
Me?
What? What?
Did either of you hear a really long buzz?
Nope, not at this
nope.
end.
Nope.
Okay,
I didn't.
Just at my end. Okay, keep going,
okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, so, yeah, well, if that's the case, if she, you know, she says she has no, she's solo with no staff, who answers the phone, makes the appointments, does the billing, makes copies for her, deals with the mail, takes care of her computers, pays the bills, et cetera, while she's seeing her 500 patients? I don't know about you, but I don't want to see my physician with frilly hair, dangly jewelry, Levi's, and clogs look professional, for goodness sake. Hasn't she ever heard of the physician placebo effect? Look like you know something. You're not the patient's mall shopping buddy. You are her physician. So here's my response. To which I said, his name's Charles. I'll just give his first name, right? As an employee at a big box clinic, I used to forfeit 74% of my annual revenue to overhead. Now, thanks to a small office with no staff, my overhead is close to 10%. By keeping 90% of my revenue, I can work part-time, 6 to 8 hours a day, 3 days a week, and exceed my full-time employed salary. This is the world that I work in. I have no significant outside income. I accept most insurance, submit claims to a free online clearinghouse, and I get paid in 2 to 3 weeks. Patients schedule online, leave messages on my answering machine, and rarely call my cell for emergencies. I answer my own phone. I open my own mail. I pay my own bills. I handle administrative tasks at my home business office, just a mile away from my clinic, where I see patients uninterrupted by the buzzing, beeping, and frenzy of a traditional medical practice. the patriarchal medical model is becoming obsolete. The traditional doctor draped in a white coat is not so favored by patients. People today value authenticity over authoritarianism. My clients want the real me, the Pamela with frizzy hair, tribal jewelry, comfy Levi's, and colorful clogs. A recent thank you card reads, "It is so refreshing to meet a real doctor with a real personality." A man shares, "Well, I, for one, would love to see doctors in less formal wear. I hate the overly stuffy and holier-than-thou look of what should be bygone days." Times are changing, Charles. Patients don't want one-size-fits-all medicine or cookie-cutter doctors. Let's be real. Compassion, intelligence, and authenticity will always be more therapeutic than a placebo outfit.
I can imagine that it could become the verbal tennis match for many issues to come.
Yeah, and I look forward to it. I love it.
After you and I were on the radio show recently together in New York, I was telling my own physician about you, and he wants to talk to you so bad. He loved everything he had heard about you and is kind of doing things in a non-traditional way anyway in his office. But what you have created is what he dreams of. So his name is Dr. Joel Ying, and he's here in Naples, Florida. Would it be okay if I got him in touch with you?
Oh, that would be wonderful, yeah. And I, you know, I teach retreats twice a year for physicians who want to learn this model, and I teach them how to be community organizers and business leaders and all of that. And it's really fun, and I can do it in like 3 days. You know, I pretty much download 8 years of 8 years of my wisdom in 3 days in a hot springs in Oregon. It's great on 150 acres of virgin forest.
I love it. And,
well,
and
he is an MD, but he calls himself an integrative practitioner. And he has a small group of about 100 other practitioners, also MDs, all over the country, who are all also integrative practitioners who are looking for a different way of doing what they love, practicing medicine. So this 100 group person group would be a perfect candidate for your retreat, I would think.
Yeah, that's great. And the thing that's so funny about integrative medicine, what they're speaking about, which is something that came up over and over again in the town hall meetings, is the patients do want an integrative approach, meaning, you know, if you can't solve their problem with Western medicine, they want you to be able to say, well, try Jan, the physical therapist down the street. She's really good. Or get a massage. Or here's Joe, and he's a great acupuncturist in town. They don't want you to just send them away and have them Googling things on their own from their, you know, bed at home. And so it's just having a holistic approach that includes all methods of healing. And what's interesting to me is sometimes the physicians who practice integrative medicine aren't necessarily integrated themselves, meaning they're still using a reductionist model sometimes and looking at the human body as a machine, and they're not necessarily themselves spiritually and emotionally integrated. And I think that's the first step in healing healthcare, is that physicians need to integrate themselves and kind of recover from this PTSD and take their souls back, you know, and be like a complete human being. Because that's what human beings want to see when they come to the doctor. They want to find another human being on the other side of the conversation, not a mechanic, you know.
Well, I've done a couple of small group workshops for people in this group, and they really are living an integrated life now.
Oh, good.
Every one
That's
of them
great.
That I have dealt with, which has been very, very impressive to see. They really do practice what they preach, but they're looking for a model that has proven
a business
successful.
Model that works.
And they haven't found it yet. So each one of them is left to figure it out on their own, none of them loving what they've got. I mean, even my own personal physician has continued to be on staff at a local hospital because he thinks he needs to, and yet that's the most miserable part of his existence. He hates it. He hates every minute of it. But he doesn't know of any other way, so he's continued to do it because he thinks he has to. And I keep encouraging him to continue looking because there are definitely other ways of doing it, and you've proven that.
Yeah, there's a gazillion other ways of practicing medicine. This is just one that worked for me in my town, and it can be replicated anywhere. But, you know, it's there. We need to make it simpler, easier, streamlined. And, I mean, one example that's so funny is just the idea of allowing people to even opt out of insurance for primary care. This is just a really interesting financial model that a lot of practices, small practices, are moving towards where they do cash only or, you know, I still take insurance. But it is interesting to think about that if we ran, let's say, the restaurant industry the way medicine is run and you had a third party that was paying for your restaurant bill, you would wait, you know, you'd wait 2 weeks for a table and have 7 minutes to eat, and your bill would be twice
as much.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? Because you're waiting.
Absolutely.
You've made this so complicated. And really what you do in primary care, people are coming in for bronchitis, hangnails, pap smears. There's no need for other people in the room. That's a two-person job, and it's pretty simple, you know? Primary care is very simple. You don't need a lot of other people asking you for the code and submitting all sorts of claims. I mean, if you have a lung transplant, you probably do need a team and a tertiary care center and a helipad and a helicopter and everything else, right? That's a different scenario. And a lot of times when we talk about healthcare, they're merging, you know, tertiary care, you know, kind of catastrophic ailments with like the simple stuff that most people need that they should be able to get. 99% of people should be able to get this 99% of the time in their own neighborhood with a doctor they love right down the street, you know?
And
well, and
I've
been encouraging this group.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Linda. I've been encouraging this group to take lessons from other small businesses, especially online businesses, and start looking at things like joint ventures. If
mm-hmm.
they really believe in the benefits of yoga and nutrition, why not joint venture with the yoga store down the street, the yoga center
mm-hmm.
down the street, the
mm-hmm.
the nutritionist down the street, the organic food store down the street, and have all of them funneling business back and forth within the group? I think it's just a natural outcropping of it.
Yeah, this one woman who I trained in Portland, she opened her office, and it was a kind of a small, almost like it feels like a New York kind of a lofty little apartment. You know what I mean? Definitely you feel like you're in a really nice art studio in her place. But she didn't have a space for like a waiting area, which again, you don't generally need. But every so often she'll run late with a patient. So she has a special deal where the coffee shop right next to her office is her waiting room. And so patients know they can go in there and get a free
awesome
cup of coffee.
Is that?
You know, if she's late, they know that they sit there and they have like a cup of coffee on her. You know what I mean? And then they just can wander from the coffee shop into her office as like a little art studio and have their exam. So we should be networking with lots of businesses.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's a win-win.
It really is. And the marketing budgets can be cut way down when you're doing that kind of a thing. You know, if they had some sort of a unified brand that they could all promote, so that people could trust that if you saw this symbol or this logo or heard this name, that it was a part of this network of people that trust one another, I think it could be really huge. And that's what I've been encouraging these people to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds great.
Go ahead, Linda. I didn't mean to step on you earlier.
Yeah,
no,
sorry.
No, this is such a perfect conversation. Pamela, part of what you and I talked about is the fact, and I want to bring it into this conversation for everyone who's listening to us, is, you know, in the same way that the guy who wrote that article is making all kinds of assumptions about what you had to be, what your reality had to be, I think it's really important to understand. You went to your customer to ask what they wanted, and that helped create the design. And in turn, you have other physicians around the country who said, really, how did you do that? And you, in turn, went around and taught them how to do town halls, how to gather the information, and how to redesign their practices. So this is not just about, oh, she's in Eugene, Oregon, and she's choosing to be a GP and so on. This is
yeah,
a model
that
works. This
isn't just a little hippie on the hill in the golden
right.
city of Eugene that can do this. Everyone can do this. These are opening all around the country. And why not? You know, really what people want is disintermediation, which means removing the middleman. They want a direct relationship with their doctor, which makes sense. I mean, it's a sacred relationship. It's like being with your spouse. How many people do you need in your bedroom at night? Do you need your CPA there? Do you need an insurance agent? Or do you just want to have like a really heart-to-heart conversation with your spouse and have like, you know, that you know, sacred time together, which really is what healing is all about, having like the complete trust and attention of a human being on the other side of you. And the whole town hall meeting thing is so fascinating to me because, you know, I could sit forever and wait for the next election cycle and hope that the next, you know, president will come to Eugene, Oregon and lead a town hall meeting and touch on the topic of health care and then maybe go back to D.C. and kind of battle it out and see if he can deliver what we want in our small town. I mean, I could wait my whole life for that. Why not just jump out of bed and lead my own town hall meeting? I don't understand why more people are not just cutting out these extra loops, right, and just going directly to their town and solving these social problems that we have, like with health care. I mean, these can be easily solved. Primary care can be so easily solved with just, you know, there's a reason why I live in Eugene, Oregon. I love it here. I don't plan to ever leave. I am committed to this town, and I have a medical diploma. Why am I waiting for somebody else to come here to figure out what my patients want and then deliver it for me? I should be doing that myself. You know
and
what I mean?
The same thing holds in Burbank or
yeah.
Lunch or it doesn't
yeah.
matter.
You love San Francisco? You're planning on living there your whole life? You've got a medical diploma? Ask your town what they want and do it. Like, don't wait. What are we waiting for? It just doesn't make any sense. Why do we have all these extra loops? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it's even bigger than medicine, right? This holds true in any kind of a business. If you're a
mm-hmm.
massage therapist, the same principle
mm-hmm.
applies. If
mm-hmm.
you're in an online information business, the same thing applies. Doesn't matter what kind of a business, it is
mm-hmm.
all the same thing. Ask
mm-hmm.
your customers what they really want and then find a way to deliver it.
Right. And it's pretty easy when they tell you what you – I mean, it does sound like – for the uninitiated, I'm going out on a limb to just go to my town and say, dream it up, I'll do it. It kind of sounds like the Make-A-Wish Foundation or something. You know, you tell me what you want and I'll do it. I mean, who knew what they were going to ask for? I was promising to deliver
right.
something that I didn't know because I really did say that you tell me what you want and I'll do it as long as it's legal. And you know what? What people
yeah.
want is so simple and so low cost. And basically what they want is a human relationship and honesty and love. And, you know, that's what really they're coming to the doctor for. They come for strep throat or their urine infection or whatever it is. But in the end, they want to feel like they were loved. They received hope, that they left as a happier person with a connection to their own body and to another person and answers for, like, their destiny. You know, and I know Gina has experienced this. It's not random what medical problems we come in contact with in our lives. I mean, these are opportunities for personal growth. You know, you
Absolutely.
Can use your pain as an epiphany to get to know more about your spiritual destiny here. We're just spiritual beings having a human experience. What is your body telling you that you're getting urine infections over and over again with your spouse? What does that really mean? You know? There's a reason why things are happening.
I often say that even though it was really painful, even though the 10 years I spent in a hospital bed and wheelchair were horrendous, more than 50 operations, all the crap I had to live through with 14 different physicians over 10 years, I would go back and do it all over again so long as I came out with the same wisdom that I gained. It was worth every bit of it because I could never have had the growth and the transformation in my life, not just
mm-hmm.
my business, but my life, without
right.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But it
yeah.
wasn't my physicians that allowed that to happen. It was only when I took control over my own destiny and I really made the choice to find a better way. My doctors were truly killing me.
Yeah. Mhm. Yeah, it's a wake-up call, having a physical complaint, you can no longer ignore it. If you can't walk or you've got a headache and you can't get out of bed or whatever it is, I mean, it's an opportunity to wake up and get to know yourself again, your real self.
Well, all
and
my doctors
what can happen
did
as a result
put a Band-Aid
is amazing.
On it.
Right.
It really is. I didn't really need a Band-Aid. I needed somebody who could really help me save my life.
Right. So I think people, or I think we're definitely underutilizing our medical appointments. You know, patients have very low expectations of what they can get out of a medical appointment. You know, they're just going to get a
Absolutely.
Prescription or a lab test or something. And physicians, these are people who wanted to be healers, who put their life on hold for 24 to 30 years, are underutilizing their capacity to heal.
And that's
most of what people
so
need is nothing
people
that you learned in medical
going,
school. Excuse me?
It's so much the reason that people aren't going to the doctors looking for a wellness plan. They're going to the doctors looking for control of a symptom. That's it. They don't know that there is any other alternative.
Mm-hmm. We've been dumbed down, and just, it's been very mechanized. And most of what people need, doctors can deliver with nothing they ever learned in medical school and just being human, really. I mean,
and
what you learn in medical school
I
is
would,
just, go ahead.
I would expect that your word of mouth referrals are huge. You probably don't even have to do much advertising to get new patients, right?
No, I don't have to do any advertising at all. And actually, most medical clinics don't, because advertising for medical clinics doesn't really work. It's usually all word of mouth. People, when they want a gynecologist or they want, you know, a physical exam, they don't generally go through the Yellow Pages or Google. They're asking their friends, who do you recommend? Because it's very personal, you know. It's very personal.
Yeah.
People, you know, are going to be exposing of themselves with a physician, and they want to make sure they're with the right one. Yeah, so generally all
word
of
mouth. What I teach my students is that when you can really touch someone's life in a profound way, when they talk about themselves, they can't help but bring up your name too. And with the unique way that you've chosen to build your practice, every person that walks in your door is going to have a profound impact on their life. So if every one of those people is out there talking about themselves and they can't help but bring up your name, before you know it, you've got way more patients that you can handle on your own, which is a great problem to have.
Yeah, I had a waiting list that was longer than the number of patients I had in my practice. At one point.
Wow,
that's incredible. And I'm constantly, like, helping other doctors in town open their own practices, and I give them my waiting list. You know, so basically my waiting list, I knew I could never get all the people in my waiting list into my practice, but I used that specifically to launch other clinics in town. Because then they have a built-in patient panel from day one. They have all my waiting list patients.
How
That's what I
awesome
do.
Is that?
Yeah.
So in your
awesome.
Own business, aside from the practice, is your focus really going out and reaching more patients, or is it going out and working with more physicians?
I think it's both. I really see this as a movement, this ideal medical care movement, kind of like, you know, civil rights or any other large movement in which we need to raise the consciousness of both the physicians and the patients, because it's a relationship. And so we need to expect more of one another, raise the bar on our behavior, and really start healing one another, because actually when the patients participate at this level, they heal their doctors. It's a bilateral relationship.
And talk about perfect timing. Timing couldn't be more perfect with the whole Obamacare thing happening.
Oh, right. And you know what? I just got invited to deliver a TED Talk on this. And so I've just been putting that together. I think you'd like, I'll read you a little bit from that if you don't mind. I think you'll really find
Please
this
do.
Enlightening. I live in the friendliest little town in America, with snow-capped mountains, farmers markets on every corner, and lots of hippies. After medical school and residency down south, I moved up to Eugene, Oregon, where I put down my textbooks and learned how to be a real doctor. At first, I was nervous. The people kind of freaked me out. Everyone is so abnormally happy, not just nice or smiley, genuinely happy, happy for no reason happy. It's unsettling. Eugene is a touchy-feely town. I've never been hugged by so many people in my life. I felt smothered. I actually had trouble breathing, so I'd search for air pockets and try not to tense up. Nothing in med school could have prepared me for receiving this much affection from my patients. For the uninitiated, here's Eugene in a nutshell. Imagine walking down the street and strangers are smiling at you like they've just had sex with you. It's weird, but now I kind of like it. It's normal. I love being a small-town doctor. With high reimbursement and low malpractice, Oregon is the ideal place to be a doctor, and I love my patients. I hug them and kiss them, and I do house calls, and most patients call me Pamela or Sweetie or Darling, and they all have my home phone number. I'm on call 24/7, but I never feel like I'm working. I love my job. I'm pretty sure I'm the happiest doctor in America. And so I'm living a fairy tale life in a happily ever after children's story until one day last year. On a perfectly beautiful fall day in the middle of our city park, one of our most loved pediatricians shot himself in the head. He wasn't the only one. He was the third in 18 months, all suicides, in the happiest town in America. At his memorial service, people kept asking why, but nobody said suicide. A gunshot wound isn't a question mark, it's an exclamation point. That's when it hit me. Both men I dated in med school are dead. Maybe they were suicides too. Brilliant physicians, loved by their communities, both died by accidental overdose. Doctors don't accidentally overdose, we dose drugs for a living. And right then and there, I pulled myself out of the cloud of euphemisms that surrounded me, and I was determined to speak the truth. I've been a doctor for 20 years. I've never lost a patient to suicide. I've lost only colleagues, friends, lovers, all male physicians. Why? Why do we have the highest suicide rate of any profession? Why in the United States do we lose 400 physicians per year to suicide, the equivalent of an entire medical school gone? I left his memorial and drove 2 hours up into the mountains. That evening, I'm welcoming physicians from the United States and Canada, all of us on a pilgrimage for answers. I'm leading a retreat for doctors who yearn to love medicine again. I open with two questions. How many doctors have lost a colleague to suicide? All hands are raised. How many have considered suicide? Except for one woman, all hands remain up, including mine. I know why doctors are dying. Because I almost died. For most doctors, our greatest joy is the patient relationship, but there's no time for relationships. We're like factory workers practicing assembly line medicine. Our bright-eyed medical students turn into burned-out doctors, checked out, eyes glazed over like they have PTSD. We see far too much pain, and a cry for help is weakness. So we pretend to be strong and invincible. We're not supposed to cry, hug, love our patients. We're not supposed to make mistakes. We live in fear of malpractice, of being reported to licensing boards, scrutinized, penalized. For what? Being human? So we pretend not to feel, and we forget how to be human. Doctoring is a calling. It's our identity. All I ever wanted to do was help people. But we can't just be people. We're doctors 24/7, and we suffer. We can feel powerless, numb, trapped, alone with no alternatives to our pain. We have easy access to lethal drugs and firearms. We have the same problems you have. We get divorced. We get addicted to drugs and porn. We amass unbearable debt. We have depression and anxiety. We're human, but we're not supposed to be human. And that's what's really wrong with healthcare in America.
Yeah, it's a message that so needs to be spoken out loud.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I continue and I say, you know, but on January 20th, 2005, I did something about it. I did something doctors don't usually do. I asked for help, not from a psychiatrist or a counselor. I asked my entire town for help. I invited my community to a town hall meeting where I shared my pain publicly, and I asked them to help me learn how to be a real doctor. an ideal doctor. I invited my community to design an ideal clinic, and they did. Over 6 weeks, I held 9 town hall meetings, collecting 100 pages of testimony. I adopted 90% of feedback, and we opened 1 month later. The first ideal medical clinic in America designed entirely by patients, and my community saved my career and my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that's my little story.
I love it. And now it's a model. It's a model spoken of. It's a model being taught in your retreats. It's a model
In medical schools. And
right.
The book that I have is being taught in medical schools and undergraduate medical humanity classes because, you know what? We need humanity back in medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm sure this can be extrapolated, replicated in many different fields, you know, many different business ventures.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And do you work with chiropractors at all?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyone in any healthcare professional can come to my retreats and, you know, can use the same sorts of, you know, the model in their offices. And I think I've even
introduced him with Dr. Fab Mancini.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. I think the two of them could do miraculous things.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Do you know who Dr.
Yes,
Fab Mancini
any
is?
Yeah. Do I know who that is? No.
He is a past president of Parker College, one of the two main chiropractic schools in the country. He has his own TV show specifically geared on wellness. I think it's on CNN, isn't it, Linda?
I believe so. And he is also, he's flown around the country and around the world teaching on how to really adopt this notion that we are our own healers.
Uh-huh.
And to view it not as combative Western medicine versus alternative integrative medicine and so on, but rather to understand it as a whole and that we individually are our own leader and participant in our own self-healing.
Uh-huh.
And he has medical centers that fly him in to speak the same talk to the physicians, the patients, and the caregivers of the patients.
Uh-huh.
So he'll give the talk 3 separate times, speaking the same information, the same message, the same ideas to each of those audiences. And I just know that the two of you could do some really phenomenal stuff together. He has his own radio show with, I think,
especially
something like a million listeners and so on. So I look forward to
especially
putting
because
the
one of the things that he gets asked for more than any other is, does he have a program that can help chiropractors implement his teachings? And he really doesn't.
Hmm. Yeah. So
your retreats
could
really fill that for him.
To help. I mean, what I sometimes see is there is a little disconnect between visionaries and people who are on the ground actually doing things. Like Patch Adams, who's a friend of mine, you know, stays in kind of a visionary realm, and, you know, he has yet to open this hospital, you know, after 40 years of talking about it. And so it's really nice to, I think I might have the perfect blend of visionary and actual practical, you know, business model. I'm not one that can sit and just dream. I'm somebody that needs to act. And it takes me very little time from the dream stage to open the doors. And so it's great because, a lot of doctors are they happen to not be in the visionary creative stage, which is why we're cycling through such a painful healthcare model over and over again. And so, yeah.
So, Linda, where can our listeners find out more about Pamela?
I'm going to ask Pamela exactly where they can do that.
Yeah, well, idealmedicalcare.org, and I would encourage anyone to just call me. Just call my office, which is 541-345-2437. I talk to everyone who calls me. I'm really very accessible, so just get in direct contact with me. I don't have any staff, so you'll be talking to me. I'll be answering the phone.
A unique experience.
Well, I'll definitely get my physician in touch with you.
Yeah, and that actually scares patients. They call up for an appointment, and I say, "Hi, it's Dr. Weibel," and they're like, "This is the doctor?" And they almost fall off their chair and forget why they're calling. And I'm like, "Yeah, when do you want to come in? Today?" And, you know, people just can't believe it. It's that accessibility that sometimes is just shocking today, you know?
It really is. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Pamela. I really enjoyed our call.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Pamela, and I'm going to be putting you and Fab together.
Okay, great.
If there's anything else that I can do personally to help you, or if Linda can do anything, please just let us know.
If nothing else, I'll send you an email. Mm-hmm. That's all.
I'll send
you
an email in a little bit. Maybe you and I can get together, and I can help you find a way to get what you're doing out to doctors in bigger numbers, because it is sorely needed in our country.
Yeah, that's great. And I think one thing that would really help is to have this included in institutions and their curriculum, you know, so that the upcoming generation.
Oh, yes.
That's the main thing that needs to happen, is that it needs to not just be something, oh, my grandma got me this book and I'm pre-med, and just individuals hearing about it through word of mouth, which is great, and it does build the kind of tsunami effect eventually of the movement, but it would be really nice to have institutions providing these kind of optimistic, medical models to the incoming students so they see a light at the end of the tunnel.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Well, Linda and I will be back next Tuesday at noon Eastern here on Blog Talk Radio for another episode of Breakthrough Directions. Have a fantastic week, everybody. Thanks, Linda. Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you.
Join us Tuesday at noon Eastern for the next episode of Breakthrough Directions, from relationship marketing to business success.